feet took off, and I stayed by the fire. There's still, I don't know, zero weather, around zero weather up there. How cold it got, I don't know, because we never did have a thermometer. I was young and tough, and standing a foot of snow and more and chop tree. I had asked the boss, the contractor, he's selling this piece of timber to the smelter in Douglas, the copper smelter. Anyway, I was tired. I sat down with a tin cup of that Magrana tea, and these three youngsters, Fred, friend, Federico friend, was one, he was a leader. They start trotting up the canyon. About an hour and a half later, here they come, with a doe tied to a long pole, two of them carrying the doe in it. Well, it didn't take long to skin it. They were afraid of the game warden. I said, I am not afraid of the game warden, but okay, we're gonna bury the hide and the head. I said, go ahead if you want to, but I wouldn't. I wouldn't hide anything. I had heard something that back in those 40 miles from a town where you could buy meat, groceries, you could kill a deer once in a while. Well, I found it was so, because I talked to the ranger later. And, anyway, we started roasting meat and using that green salt, the horse leaves.
I want to ask you, did the running water, did it take the smoke smell out of the potatoes?
The potatoes and the beans.
Did it?
But by the time we had the beans cooked, we had no salt. So the beans were without salt. Potatoes without salt. Now the potatoes, when you wash them, they're in the jacket. When you peel them and wash them again, you didn't get no skunk. But our clothes, even my clean clothes, that had been more or less, I always kept a suit of underwear under my pillow, the mattress. I was the only one with a mattress there. And to keep them warm, even they got impregnated. In fact, when I got down into Douglas, not very long after that, just before Christmas, right after Christmas, we spent Christmas up there. Right after Christmas, I went down into Douglas, and then it's almost New Year's when I got into Douglas to my sister's place, because they shut the work down. The smelter people didn't want that timber, it wasn't what they wanted. What they wanted timber was a lot of rotting. Resonated. What they did, I found out later, that they take a pair of tongs and a big vat of molten copper. They'd shove these logs down slowly, and of course the molten copper would burn them. And the ashes would bring up all the impurities in the copper, the purely refined copper. Then they'd run them off into molds. This is what I found out. But I've always asked the question, what do they want this timber for in the smelters? I knew they wouldn't be burning it. And only special logs of certain sizes, they didn't want any log. But anyway, we came into Douglas when I was walking around the street. I had washed my hat. In fact, it had been my father's old Stetson hat. I had washed it, washed my clothes. I had taken a bath in that icy water with a big fire on the bank. We're getting that soap up and jump in that water, roll around a little bit, jump on it and rush to the fire, and freezing. It was cold. And I'd be walking down the street in Douglas and tell my sister to keep that hat off. Go wash your head. I wasn't wearing any of the clothes, even if she got me. I got some more clothes, and new clothes. And if you don't wear those, I'll wash them again. Boiling water. We had nothing to boil them in over there, So, but when I was wearing that hat, on that first day I was wearing one of the shirts. I hadn't worn it up in the mountains. People, especially women, would, as I went by, they'd walk away from me. I couldn't smell it, and I was used to it. You get used to that smell and you can't notice it. But my sister, she laughed. I told her about it. It was down the street. You don't want to take that shirt off, just take that hat. She says, I can smell you. lavish part of it. Anyway, sometime later, this nephew that had come after me and we rode that freight train, we had, before that, before I had gone up to work in the Chiricahua, we had made a trip to El Paso. Let me say, freight trains were free. We went to visit an old friend that we had known in Corona. He was an ex-fighter. And this nephew had been a fighter. And trying, you know, making little money during the Depression. $5 for a fight, 4 rounds. Getting their brains knocked out, beat up. And I was pretty good with the gloves, and they'd ask me, why don't you box? Well, we put you on the main event because they know I was pretty good. No, I'm not going to get my brains beat out for $10. Give me $100 and I'll do it. Oh, and we can afford that. Well, that was during the Depression. Little arenas all over the state, in Southern California. But anyway, we made this trip to El Paso. We stopped at one of his aunts. She gave us a good breakfast. Then we went to visit his friend of ours. We stayed there all day. He gave me some clothes, and his mother had given us another good meal. And then we went out to catch the return train to Douglas. We got on a train, and about 10, 15 minutes, we discovered we were on the wrong train. We were going to go clear around to Douglas. No money, no lunch, and we knew the schedule of these freight trains. We rode it all night long, part of the next day, and we ended up in Tucson.
Where did you ride at? I mean, inside freight cars or?
Oh, we'd ride in open cars, sometimes on top. In summertime, we'd ride on top, flat cars, anywhere. In gondolas, I like to ride gondolas because the wind was going too hard. I lean up against one way, the wind wouldn't be blowing.
What's a gondola?
That's an open car with sides on it. The flat car is like a table. The box car, well, it's boxing with doors, sliding doors. And the cattle car, you don't ride those in the wintertime, especially, or at summertime, because they've got the slats open.
Did you have any problems with the railroad police?
No. At that time, the government the federal government asked the railroad companies to allow people to ride, because so they wouldn't have just accumulated in some towns. You know, in those days, there was actually murders. And for instance, in Phoenix about that time, we read about it, heard about it. And word of mouth from one man to another, some traveling that way would tell something unusual happened on the railroad track back here. He'd tell this man, he'd carry it on the other way. And this one carried on the other way. And anyway, for instance, if we were riding a car, 40 or 50 of us, and a man and a wife and a child or two children would get on that same car, maybe they don't know what, he didn't have a chance to get on another car. We would all move to one half of the car, pack it over there, maybe if we'd have to. We'd leave a half to the family. It was an unwritten rule that the people had. And the next time the train stopped, somebody would get out and look for another empty, and he'd find one, he'd come pass the word, and we'd get out and leave that one car for that family. Sometimes it'd be two families, three families. You'd look in and be two, three families. Actually, children carrying babies in their arms. This is some of the things that I saw.
Were they all different colors and races, or just...
No, I didn't see no Negro families traveling. I saw quite a few Negro men traveling. Mostly all were whites, Anglos. Oklahoma, mostly, Arkansas, the real poor states over there where the people were really poor, where the Depression really hit them, you know? And anyway, I saw an ex-banker, a bandmaster, musician, he was an orchestra leader. I met the man, and he pulled out a watch and said, "That's all I have left." He was well-dressed. Next day, we heard that he had committed suicide. He couldn't take it. He was an old man. I met a young boy whose father had been a banker, a young fellow, and he went broke during the late 20s, remember when the bottom dropped out of everything, 28, 29? That's when the Depression really started. Mm-hmm. And everybody went broke. Banks went broke. Big business went broke. This banker went broke and he committed suicide. The boy was going to, had been going to college and he had to drop out. And I met him on a real nice young fellow. So, I always traveled alone, or with one good partner, somebody I knew. Because a lot of these youngsters were hellraisers. Imagine a group of youngsters getting in a car, opening, forcing the doors open to a Hershey car. Nothing but Hershey bars in there. And start scattering Hershey bars from just the side of Yuma all the way to needles. Not needle, but nylon, where the train stopped to change engine material. And they went on through. They quit there and got another train. And there they hung Hershey bars all along the little tracks. Well, I stayed away from those groups. And coming back from El Paso, when we took the wrong train, we knew we were going to end up in Tucson. One whole day ride, train ride from Douglas. All night long, all the next day, we spent the night in Tucson and wait for a train the next day. Now, my nephew had a little more nerve than I had, and he was younger in a way. He wasn't about to go hungry. He went into town and the Salvation Army fed him some donuts and coffee. He said he tried to sneak one for me or two, but he couldn't. Well, just across from where we spent the night, just laying there, kind of cold. The winter was coming. That was just before I went to the Chief House. And there was a high fence, wire and wood, and on the backside there was a domestic cactus, prickly pear. Well, he had nerve, the boy had nerve. He climbed this fence and started knocking prickly pear down. Now, further down the line where the train, when it pulled out of Tucson, it stopped to get water. These were the old steam engines then. They had to stop for water every so often. Maybe 250 miles, 200 miles, they had what they call a line out, where they worked the engines over. Now they don't have them. Every 400 or 500 miles they have a roundhouse or where they repair these diesels. Well, along the track where this train would stop to water up, we knew there was a wild cactus there. And it was just time for the prickly pear. And they're really tasty fruit. I like them better than the domestic kind. The domestic kind of reddish, you've probably seen them in the store. Mm-hmm. Big red cactus pears, prickly pears, and about that big around. Well, these are smaller, purple, real dark purple. And you have to knock them down on the grass. Pima Indian taught me. And you cut some brush and something, and you sweep them through the grass around the rocks. Roll them around and knock all the little fine spines off. And then you peel them. If you got a knife, all the better. Well, I always carry the knife, pocket knife. Cut the stem side and then peel them and eat the whole thing. If you just eat the inside, which is a tasty sweet seed, you can get bound up or, you know, constipated with the seeds. Now, the domestic kind, you slice them this way and you eat the heart, which is mostly seed, but it's got a lot of meat sweet in it. You know, that won't bother, it won't hurt you, but the wild one will. So I cut a bucketful. We found an old tin can, 5 gallon can, and I practically filled them up when the train started to pull out. I hand them over to him. He climbed up first and I hand them up to him. He climbed up on top. There's a little Negro boy with a very bad, bad throat. And I said, eat some of these. He couldn't eat. He said he couldn't eat and took some. Try some of this. And it's a little bit, have a little slime on it, more easy to slide down. But just try that. He ate about three. And he liked them. He said, that's enough. I don't want to. But anyway, that's all we had to eat in 2 days. It was prickly pears. We ended up in Douglas. My sister and his wife, my niece, they cooked a big lunch for us, you know. He was getting help from the city, from the county, I guess. My sister was working for a doctor, and she was doing all right. Shortly after that was when I went up to Chiricahuas on a job, and then came back. My sister had run out of work, and then this nephew, he had, one, two, three, four brothers. They had run the Chinaman out of Sonora, just like they had other places. And there was one, he was a Mexican citizen, was on the Chinese, the slaughter ranch, which had been, had, or was the slaughter ranch. That was the name of the place at the time. There had been an hacienda right there, and when I saw the foundation, when I got, anyway, my nephew asked me to help him carry a bedstead. He'd got a job with his brothers. They had rented this land from somebody. I never asked if they got it directly from Slaughter or an agent or what. Chinaman had been farming there, and Bill Best was an old lumberjack. He'd been run out of Mexico. He took his job. See, in the early 30s or late 29, the American government had picked up all the Mexican people. They didn't care whether they were, they didn't ask whether they were citizens or non-citizens or what. They just picked them up, loaded them on freight trains, on trains, passenger trains, took them to the borders and shelled them off. A lot of American citizens, young children, you know. They didn't let them even, some cases, didn't even let them pick up any clothes. And there, for instance, in Colton, they owned their home. They'd been there for 20, 30 years. Some didn't have no papers. They came in when there was no need for papers. All they had to show was a $20 gold piece or a $20 bill when they allowed them in. But they had to show that much money anyway because they didn't want it to be wards of the counties or the cities or towns, you know. Well, there's very little danger of that. There's a lot of work for those people, and they were not afraid to work for whatever they could get. Just like today, the wetback. They'll work for a dollar an hour. If that's all they can get. To them, $8 a day is big money over there.
Well, why were all the Chinese
in Mexico, the Chinese were taking over in the politics, or they'd buy the politicians, and they wouldn't hire any native Mexicans, you know, and they hadn't got control of the farms, the big farms, and they were in big business. I had seen them in Mexicali. They had run them out of Lower California.
Is this just in one state of Mexico? Or?
Sonora, yes. Sonora. No, I think maybe they run them out of other states, but Sonora and Lower California, northern part of Lower California, was where they came in by the thousands. They paid up $300 to come in, and then $10 a month. Well, they made it. They were backed by a big, what do you call these Chinese tongs in San Francisco? They're bringing them in here. By bringing them into Lower California and then to Sonora. Well, eventually the government got, the people got, put the pressure on, and they loaded them on ships and sent them to, back to China. Well, in this ranch, one of the owners that had been there, Perico they call him, the Perico is a parrot. He was a citizen, a Mexican citizen. And I went to help my nephew. Oh, it was a cold January or late December. Well, right before, after Christmas it was. I don't remember. Right around there. 1931 when I went over there to the ranch. I spent the night on a Sunday. His other brother had hauled him up. I was taking us over just across the border. He only had to go about a half a mile and we'd be right on to the ranch. And just across the border there was another rancher, Brown. He had cattle in there. He was renting from Slaughter, just for cattle, for grazing. And he was crooked. I found that out sometime later. I could have turned him into the law, but I didn't want to. But I would have had to admit I had no business over there across the border working. I could visit, but no, not work. So anyway, I'll digress back. When the American government picked up all these Mexican people and took them across the border.
Do you know what year that was?
Around 29 or 30, 1930, 31, somewhere in there. They were picking up, they didn't do it just one day. They kept picking them up wherever they could get a hold of them, you know, from all over the southern part of the state. Well, the Mexican government sent all the Americans out, American citizens out. No job. You can't work. You can't hold any kind of a business here. They had to sell their business and what have you, those that had a business. And Bill Best had been in charge of the commissary at a mine in Sonora. He was a nice guy, married to my nephew's sister. He'd married in Chihuahua. He'd been captured by Pancho Villa, and he turned him loose. And he got his wife out. He couldn't come north. He had to go south to Mexico City, from Mexico City with all the rest of the Americans in Mexico during the Revolution. He went to Veracruz. From there, they shipped him over here, and he ended up in Douglas, where his in-laws were. Uh-huh. That was Bill Best. Well, he backed him with the money, his brother-in-law's, and they started farming over there. One was really a farmer, but they didn't let him take charge. Another one, cocky, snotty, big shot guy, as soon as he was made him the boss, the rest of the brothers, Bill Best and the other brothers, agreed, make him the boss. Oof, man. Anyway, it was on a Sunday when I landed there at that place with my nephew. Three men were fighting a small Sonata mule. It weighed about 800-900 pounds, a small mule. Fighting to put the bridle on, collar. And I chuckled, not knowing this man, the boss, Luis Varela was the name, not knowing at all. I hadn't met him. I had met Joe. I had worked with Joe on his little farm about 30 miles from Douglas. And he was a farmer, a real farmer. But they wouldn't listen to him. That is, the other boy, the boss, wouldn't listen to him. I didn't know this man too well, so I shut my mouth off, kind of kidding, chuckling. I never expected to get anything out of it. I said, oh, some farmers, three men, to put a bridle on that little mule. I could put the bridle and collar on that mule all by myself in 10 minutes or less. So I said, okay, all right, in Spanish. I said, we'll see. You come back here tomorrow, you put the bridle and collar on that mule in 10 minutes, and you've got a job. How much a day? Peso a day. A peso and a half was amounted to 36 cents American. Well, I had started to grow a mustache sometime before there, and I let my mustache grow. I was wearing a pair of chip away boots with hobnails, which was American. But I knew it was against the law for me to then go to work. So I said, all right. Well, my nephew said, well, it's against the law for me to work here too, but they won't ask no questions. The boss is here, his older brother was not a citizen. But he had a right to be in the United States. He'd come in legally, you know. And Joe was a citizen. Joe lives over here in Downey now.
An old man like me?
Not as old as I am, but nowhere near as old as I am. They were youngsters compared to me. Joe was about 27, 28, I guess. Luis was younger, and then there was my nephew, and then another one. Two more. No, one more. Youngster, about 13. All good workers. Anyway, I got the job. A peso a day. 8 hours a day, 9 hours a day. And my niece said, well, Tio, she said, what she called me, Tio, and uncle, you don't have to pay for the boy. Well, I'll take care of you. Won't even cost you 50 cents to feed you a week. They got their flour cheap in Agua Prieta, Blackwater, that's the Mexican town. They bought their sugar cheap. Coffee was only a little bit high, about 2 cents a pound. Tobacco, you get a paper bag that big for 25 centavos.
a foot square?
Huh?
About a foot square?
Yeah, about not much bigger than this.
Right.
Right. 25,000. Well, we used corn husks to find for the paper, or somebody go to Joe or sometimes would pick up, you got the paper for nothing at the cigarette or tobacco stores. You know, Bull Durham, we could get 3 Bull Durham for 10 cents in those days on the American side. A sack of flour for 35 cents, 25 pounds. And a hamburger, 2 cents a pound, and all that. So even the dollar a day could go a long ways. But over there it was, I boarded out 1 week, worked the 6 days, and he paid me in 6 pesos, and then he made me a proposition. So I'll give you a peso and a half, says, you get up at 3 in the morning, feed all the horses, all the stock, milk the cow, and make breakfast for the rest of us. Now his mother was there, she would make supper or dinner. The Chinaman, Perico, he'd make lunch, of course. But I had to make breakfast. Not much to make, you know, a lot of eggs, beans, and potatoes, and corned beef, or fresh meat. Yeah, I'd chop it up in a little onion and something, and break some eggs in it, and they were contented with my cooking. I make biscuits. I didn't make no tortillas. I made a lot of biscuits. And big wood stove, lots of wood. Well, anyway, so I agreed. No time limit. Now, in the evenings after we'd all eat, he'd call the men in, he'd pay them a little extra. How much, I don't know. He'd go out, he'd send some man out in the mesas to cut sota. It's something like a yucca, long leaf. Then we'd split that, the flat side, and then slice it the other way with razor blades. That's what they used to tie vegetables with. Watercress. There was a big ditch, just masses of watercress. They sold that, and Douglas sold it in Nova Prieta. They had a good deal if they only had somebody who knew how to manage it and how to farm. Planting in the wrong time, too much water, and I try to tell this big boss, you don't know nothing. That's the way the channel used to do it. I don't ask Perico, está loco, está loco. I'm sorry. Why don't you tell him? Huh? Huh. You tell him in Spanish, it's a waste of time to tell him. He knows it all. No? Anyway, there's where I think, I don't know the name, I would have to dig, well, maybe somebody in Douglas or our Prieta would tell me what the name of that hacienda was, that ranch, before Slaughter got a hold of it. It used to be a place where there was spring water coming just boiling out of the ground, rich, rich soil, sacaton, grass, special grass as high as that almost, in bunches. And there was a valley there where you could walk down and find one of these places where the water had cut, come out of the mesas, and cut the ground. You could walk in like walking through a tunnel, that deep, and then the grass up above you. At least when the Apaches used to come through there, they could actually, at night time, drop in one of them, some of these and then sneak right up to the hacienda if they wanted to. Well, anyway, this is, I'm pretty sure, this is the place where my father had told us a little story about a young boy and a horse. Well, the horse became famous. The boy started him off. A racehorse. Anyway, in Agua Prieta at that time that I was there, I heard the story of the native there that worked at the ranch. There was about 10 or 12 of them working on this ranch. There was a lot of work to do there, but very poorly managed, with a lot of waste of energy. I knew this. Anyway, I'm going too far ahead and moving off of the track. These two mules, I told about, okay, I'll take the mules. But I will want nobody else to handle those mules. Nobody. I'm going to train them. And I want to handle them. Nobody. He agreed. Well, this has no regular time limit. I was sorry about it. I made that one that far. I should have put a time limit. 3 in the morning, sometime 11 o'clock at night for a peso and a half. That's 36 cents American at that time. I was young, and I made the deal.